I believe so much in women's working. I believed then in work, but under conditions that left the worker human after the day's toil was done. I believed that working women should have in life this human satisfaction. This is why, then as now, I wanted to do my share, to see that other toilers got an equal day's pay for an equal day's work, regardless of whether they were men or women. But I found that women are a branded sex, and I saw that so long as women are branded as the inferior sex and men are distinguished as the superior sex, there is no hope in the market of the world of an equal day's pay for an equal day's work. There is no fair chance anywhere until that stigma is removed, which declares women an inferior sex in the business of life.
The bitter battle over a New York State amendment granting women the vote was won by the suffragists in 1917. Carrie Chapman Catt addressed the Congress of the United States.
Women's suffrage is inevitable. Suffragists knew it before November 6, 1917. Opponents afterward. Distinct causes make it inevitable. The history of our country. The American revolutionists boldly proclaimed the heresies, taxation without representation is tyranny. Governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. 80 years after the revolution, Abraham Lincoln welded those two maxims into a new one. Ours is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. 50 years more passed, and Woodrow Wilson proclaimed to the world, "We are fighting for the things which we have always carried nearest our hearts, for democracy, for the right of those who submit to authority to have a voice in their own government." However stupidly our country may have evaded the logical application at times, it has never swerved from its devotion to the theory of democracy as expressed by those two axioms. The logic of the situation calls for immediate action. The case against women's suffrage, carefully prepared by the combined wit, skill, and wisdom of opponents during 60 years, has been closed. The jury of the New York electorate heard it all, weighed the evidence, and pronounced it incompetent, irrelevant, and immaterial. In conclusion, we know, and you know that we know, that it has been the aim of both dominant parties to postpone women's suffrage as long as possible. The party machines have evaded, avoided, tricked, and buffeted this question from Congress to legislatures to political conventions. I confess to you that many of us have a deep and abiding distrust of all existing political parties. They have tricked us so often and in such unscrupulous fashion that our doubts are natural. Some of you are leaders of those parties and all are members. Your parties, we also know, have a distrust and suspicion of new women voters. Let us counsel together. Woman's suffrage is inevitable. You know it. The political parties will go on. We know it. Shall we then be enemies or friends? Gentlemen, we hereby petition you, our only designated representatives, to redress our grievances by the immediate passage of the federal suffrage amendment and to use your influence to secure its ratification in your own state in order that the women of our nation may be endowed with political freedom before the next presidential election, and that our nation may resume its world leadership in democracy.
Jane Addams is known for her work as social worker, feminist, and pacifist. She founded Hull House in 1889. She was the first vice president of the National American Woman Suffrage Association. Miss Addams' work in the peace movement led to her receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in 1931. Jane Addams comments on the work and commitment of the American women towards peace during World War I.
Why should it be surprising that certain women in every country have remained steadfast to their old occupation of nurturing life? That they have tenaciously held to their anxious concern that men should live through all the contagion and madness of the war fever which is infecting the nations of the earth. The efforts at spiritual adjustment necessitated by the war are attempted by many people. As I met those women who were bearing their hardships and sorrows so courageously, I often caught a glimpse of an inner struggle as if two of the most fundamental instincts, the two responsible for our very development as human beings, were at strife with each other. The first is tribal loyalty, such unquestioning acceptance of the tribe's morals and standards that the individual automatically fights when the word comes. The second is woman's deepest instinct, that the child of her body must be made to live. The suffering mothers of the disinherited feel the stirring of the old impulse to protect and cherish their unfortunate children. And women's haunting memories instinctively challenge war as the implacable enemy of their age-long understanding. On the whole, I am quite inclined to agree with Chesterton when he wrote, "Many people have imagined that feminine politics would be merely pacifist or humanitarian or sentimental. The real danger of feminine politics is too much of masculine policy."
Mrs. Mary Harris Jones, better known as Mother Jones, lived from 1830 to 1930. She did not become active in union organizing until the 1870s and 80s. Mother Jones worked at first for the Knights of Labor and later became a familiar sight in the coal towns of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Colorado, organizing for the United Mine Workers. She continued to be an active and defiant woman well into her 90s. In her autobiography, she tells about one of her experiences in 1900, organizing in the Pennsylvania coal region. In Arnott, Pennsylvania, a strike has been going on for 4 or 5 months. The men were becoming discouraged. I held a meeting. It was not as large a gathering as those we had later, but I stirred up the poor wretches that did come. "You've got to take the pledge," I said. "Rise and pledge to stick to your brothers and the union till the strike's won." The men shuffled their feet, but the women rose, their babies in their arms, and pledged themselves to see that no one went to work in the morning. The secretary of the Arnott Union, a young boy, took me up to the mountain to a miner's house. Early in the morning, his wife rose to keep the children quiet so that I might sleep a little later, as I was very tired. At 8 o'clock, she came into my room crying. "Mother, are you awake?" "Yes, I am awake." "Well, you must get up. The sheriff is here to put us out for keeping you. This house belongs to the company." The family gathered up all their earthly belongings, which weren't much, took down the holy pictures and put them in a wagon, and they with all their neighbors went to the meeting. The sight of that wagon with the sticks of furniture and the holy pictures and the children, with the father and mother and myself walking along through the streets, turned the tide. It made the men so angry that they decided not to go back that morning to the mines. Instead, they came to the meeting where they determined not to give up the strike until they had won the victory. Then the company tried to bring in scabs. I told the men to stay home with the children for a change and let the women attend to the scabs. I organized an army of women housekeepers. On a given day, they were to bring their mops and brooms, and the army would charge the scabs up at the mines. The general manager, the chef, and the corporation hirelings heard of our plans and were on hand. The day came, and women came with the mops and brooms and pails of water. I decided not to go up to the drip mouth myself, for I knew they would arrest me and that might rout the army. I selected as leader an Irish woman who had a most picturesque appearance. She had slept later, and her husband had told her to hurry up and get into the army. She had grabbed a red petticoat and slipped it over a thick cotton nightgown. She wore a black stocking and a white one. She had tied a little red fringe shawl over her wild red hair. Her face was red and her eyes were mad. I looked at her and felt that she would raise a rumpus. I said, "You lead the army up to the drip mouth. Take that tin dishpan you have with you and your hammer. And when the scabs and the mules come up, begin to hammer and howl. Then all of you hammer and howl and be ready to chase the scabs with your mops and brooms. Don't be afraid of anyone. Up the mountain side, yelling and hollering, she led the women, and when the mules came up with the scabs and the coal, she began beating on the dishpan and hollering, and all the army joined in with her. The sheriff tapped her on the shoulder. "My dear lady," said he, "remember the mules. Don't frighten them." She took the old tin pan and she hit him with it and she hollered, "To hell with you and the mules." He fell over and dropped into the creek. Then the mules began to rebel against scabbing. They bucked and kicked the scab drivers and started off for the barn. The scabs started running downhill, followed by the army of women with their mops and pails and brooms. There was a great big doctor in the crowd, a company lapdog. He had a little satchel in his hand, and he said to me, impudent-like, "Mrs. Jones, I have a warrant for you." "All right," said I. "Keep it in your pill bag until I come for it. I am going to hold a meeting now." From that day on, the women kept continual watch of the mines to see that the company did not bring in scabs. Every day, women with brooms or mops in one hand and babies in the other arms wrapped in little blankets, went to the mines and watched that no one went in. And all night long they kept watch. They were heroic women. In the long years to come, the nation will pay them high tribute, for they were fighting for the advancement of a great country.
There once was a Union maid, she never was afraid of guards and ginks and company finks or deputy sheriffs that made the raid. She went to the Union Hall when a meeting it was called, and when the Legion boys come round, she always stood her ground.
"Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking by the Union, I'm sticking by the Union, I'm sticking by the Union.
Oh, no, you can't scare me, I'm sticking by the Union, I'm sticking by the Union to the day I die." She went to the picket line one morning just at 9, and the guards and ginks and company finks came a-skipping through the morning dew. They had their clubs and guns, they had their knives and bombs, they stood as still as if they did when she jumped up and said,
"Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking by the Union.
Keep going.
I'm sticking by the Union.
Yay, sister.
I'm sticking by the Union.
Say it again.
Oh, no, you can't scare me, I'm sticking by the Union.
Right on, sister.
I'm sticking by the Union till the day I die."
When the Union boys, they seen this pretty little Union queen stand up and sing in the deputy's face, they laughed and yelled all over the place. And you know what they'd done, these two gun company thugs. When they heard this Union song, they tucked their tail and run.
"Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking by the Union."
"That's right, sister.
Sticking by the Union.
I'm sticking by the Union."
"Oh, no, you can't scare me, I'm sticking by the Union. I'm sticking by the Union till the day I die."
In 1972, workers walked out at a university. We stayed away for 68 days and liberated the building trades. At the start, our leaders told us, brothers stand together. And an awful hiss went through the hall. Half of us were sisters. But at the end, they told us we have stood together, brothers and sisters. And here's our song.
We modern union maids are also not afraid to walk the line, leave jobs behind. And we're not just the ladies' aid. We fight for equal pay, and we will have our say. We're workers to the same as you and fight the union way.
Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking by the union.
Child care sector.
Sticking by the union.
Maternity leave.
Sticking by the union.
Equal pay.
Oh, no, you can't scare me. I'm sticking by the union.
Women on the exec
board. I'm sticking by the union till the day I die.
Don't call us dear or honey or little lady sunny. We're women free with dignity, no cutie playboy bunny. So neither are we men, so listen once again.
If you call us brother, we'll call you mother.
Sister is the name.
Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking by the union. I'm sticking by the union. I'm sticking by the union. Oh, no, you can't scare me. I'm sticking by the union. I'm sticking by the union till the day I die.
Emma Goldman was a leading American anarchist around the turn of the 20th century. Here, she speaks out on the issue of woman suffrage.
I am not opposed to woman suffrage on the conventional ground that she is not equal to it. I see neither physical, psychological, nor mental reasons why woman should not have the equal right to vote with man. But that cannot possibly blind me to the absurd notion that woman will accomplish that wherein man has failed. The American suffrage movement has been, until very recently, altogether a parlor affair, absolutely detached from the economic needs of the people. Thus Susan B. Anthony, no doubt an exceptional type of woman, was not only indifferent but antagonistic to labor. In 1869, she advised women to take the places of striking printers in New York. There are, of course, some suffragists who are affiliated with working women, but they are a small minority and their activities are essentially economic. The rest look upon toil as a just provision of providence. Few countries have produced such arrogance and snobbishness as America. Particularly is this true of the American woman of the middle class. She not only considers herself the equal of man, but his superior, especially in her purity, goodness, and morality. Small wonder that the American suffragist claims for her vote the most miraculous powers. In her exalted conceit, she does not see how truly enslaved she is, not so much by man as by her own silly notions and traditions. Suffrage cannot ameliorate that sad fact. It can only accentuate it, as indeed it does.
Her views on woman's emancipation were controversial for her time.
The great movement of true emancipation has not met with a great race of women who could look liberty in the face. Their narrow, puritanical vision banished man as a disturber and doubtful character out of their emotional life. But woman's freedom is closely allied with man's freedom, and many of my so-called emancipated sisters seem to overlook the fact that a child born in freedom needs the love and devotion of each human being about him. Man as well as woman. Unfortunately, it is this narrow conception of human relations that has brought about a great tragedy in the lives of the modern man and woman. History tells us that every oppressed class gained true liberation from its masters through its own efforts. It is necessary that woman learn that lesson, that she realize that her freedom will reach as far as her power to achieve her freedom reaches.
Here we come, the freedom ladies, with our tennis shoes laced tight. Each one has her hat pin ready, just in case you want to fight. You better listen when she tells you how to load the coffee pot. Chances are, the next time you might like some coffee, she might not. If she has a dinner party honoring her latest book, well, it's her night to let her light shine and her husband's turn to cook. And if her neighbors talk about the way she doesn't wash her floors, she might let them know she doesn't like the way they fight their wars. Or as few, loving them the more because she's doing what she wants to do. Give her room before she gets her balance, she'll swing out too far. Swing along as she comes back, she might surprise you even more. Hey, take a look at that happy woman. Notice how she's hit her stride. See that smile, it had to fight its way out from the person down inside.
When Margaret Sanger was a young woman, long before her career in public service and family planning, she had trouble deciding what to do with her life. Mother was amazed when I burst in on her. "I will never go back to that school again," I exclaimed dramatically. "I have finished forever. I'll go to jail, I'll work, I'll starve, I'll die. But back to that school and teacher, I will never go." As older brothers and sisters drifted home in the evening, they were as horrified as Mother. "But you have only 2 weeks more," they expostulated. "I don't care if it's only an hour. I will not go back." When it became obvious that I would stick to my point, Mother seemed glad to have me help her. I was thorough and strong and could get through a surprising amount of work in no time. But the rest of the family was seriously alarmed. The next few months were filled with questions I could not answer. What can you ever be without an education? Are you equipped to earn a living? Is factory life a pleasant prospect? If you don't go back to school, you will surely end there. My impulse had been misconstrued. I was not rebelling against education as such, but only against that particular school and that particular teacher. When fall drew near and the next session was at hand, I still had no answer to Nan's repeated, "What are you going to do?" Nan was perhaps the most inspiring of all my brothers and sisters. She herself wanted to write and had received prizes for her stories, but the family was too dependent upon the earnings of the older girls, and she was obliged to postpone college and her equally ardent desire to study sculpture. She became a translator of French and German until these aspirations could be fulfilled. She and Mary, joining forces, looked together for a school. Private education was not so expensive as today, and families of moderate means could afford it. My sisters selected Claverack College, about 3 miles from the town of Hudson in the Catskill Mountains. One sister paid for my tuition, the other bought my books and clothes. For my board and room, I was to work. Going away to school was epochal in my life. The self-contained family group was suddenly multiplied to 500 strangers, all living and studying under one roof. I liked best the attitude of the teachers. They were not so much policemen as companions and friends, and their instruction was individual and stimulating. Assembly was held in the chapel every morning, during which we all in turn had to render small speeches and essays or recite selections of poetry. I had a vivid feeling of how things should be said, and the elocution teacher encouraged me to have faith in my talents. One vacation, I announced to my family that I was thinking of a stage career. Disapproval was evident on all sides. Mary alone held out hope. She would apply immediately to the head of an acting school to have me understudy Maud Adams, whom I at least was said to resemble physically, small and with the same abundant red hair. The application was made. A return letter from the school management came, enclosing a form to be filled in with name, address, age, height, weight, color of hair, eyes, skin. But additional data were required as to the exact length of the legs, both right and left, as well as measurements of ankle, calf, knee, and thigh. I knew my proportions in a general way, but to see such personal information go coldly down on paper to be sent off to strange men was unthinkable. Since I could not see what legs had to do with being a second Maud Adams, I did not send in the printed form, but just put it all away and turn to other fields where something besides legs was to count. Chapel never bored me. Young sprouts here were thinking and discussing the Bible, religion, and politics. We scribbled during study periods, debated in the evenings. To most of the boys and girls, those Saturday mornings when the more ambitious efforts were offered represented genuine torture. I was just as nervous. Nevertheless, I was so ardent for suffrage, for anything which would emancipate women and humanity, that I was eager to proclaim theories of my own. When news spread that I was to present my essay, Women's Rights, the boys jeered and drew cartoons of women wearing trousers, stiff collars, and smoking huge cigars. I studied and wrote as never before, stealing away to the cemetery and standing on the monuments over the graves. Each day, in the quiet of the dead, I repeated that speech out loud. What an essay it was! Various pranks occurred at Claverack, and towards the end of my last year, I thought up the idea that several of us should slip out through the window and down to the village dance hall where our special admirers would meet us. About 11:30, in the midst of the gaiety, in walked our principal, Mr. Flack. We were all marched back to school, uneasy but silent. The next morning, I received a special invitation to call at the office. I entered. Without looking around, Mr. Flack said, "Miss Higgins, don't you feel rather ashamed of yourself for getting those girls into trouble last night by taking them out and making them break the rules?" I could not deny it, but it flashed across my mind at first that someone must have told him. He went on with rapid flow, almost as if talking to himself. "I have watched you ever since you came, and I don't need to be told that you must have been the ringleader. Again and again, I've noticed your influence over the others. You must make your choice, whether to get yourself and others into difficulty, or else guide yourself and others into constructive activities which will do you and them credit." I do not quite recall what else he said, but I have never forgotten going out of his room that day. This could not exactly be called a turning point in my life, but from then on I realized more strongly than before that there was a something within myself which could and should be kept under my control and direction. I spent 3 happy years at Claverack. The following season, I decided to try my hand at teaching, then a ladylike thing to do. The majority of the pupils, Poles, Hungarians, Swedes, could not speak English. I was beside myself to know what to do with 84 children who could not understand a word I said. I love those small black-haired and tow-headed urchins, but I was so tired at the end of the day that I often lay down before dressing for dinner and awakened the next morning barely in time to start the routine. In very short order, I became aware of the fact that teaching was not merely a job, it was a profession. I was not suited by temperament, and therefore had no right to this vocation. I had been struggling for only a brief while when Father summoned me home to nurse Mother. In an effort to be more efficient in caring for Mother, I tried to find out something about consumption by borrowing medical books from the library of the local doctor. In doing this, I became so interested in medicine that I decided definitely I would study to be an M.D. When I went back for more volumes and announced my decision, the doctor gave them to me but smiled tolerantly. "You'll probably get over it." It was a folk superstition that a consumptive who survived through the month of March would live until November. Mother died on the 31st of the month, leaving Father desolate and inconsolable. The house was quiet. He hardly spoke. I had to take Mother's place, manage the finances, order the meals, pay the debts. There was nothing left for my clothing, nor for any outside diversions. All that could be squeezed out by making this or that do had to go for shoes or necessities for the younger brothers. To add to my woes, Father seemed to me suddenly metamorphosed from a loving, gentle, benevolent parent into a most aggravating, irritating tyrant. His unreasonableness was not directed toward the boys, but towards us daughters, Ethel and me. Whatever we did was wrong. At last I realized why Father had been so different. He'd been lonely for Mother, lonely for her love. Then, too, he'd always before depended on her to understand and direct us. He was probably a trifle jealous, since Bose had been sidetracking the affection of his little girls. His belated discipline, caused by worry and anxiety, was merely an attempt to guide his children. I, however, considered the time had passed for such guidance. Though the immediate occasion for reading medical books had ceased with Mother's death, I had never lost my deep conviction that perhaps she might have been saved had I had sufficient knowledge of medicine. This was linked up with my latent desire to be of service in the world. The career of a physician seemed to fulfill all my requirements. I could not at the moment see how the gap in education from Claverack to medical school was to be bridged. Nevertheless, I could at least make a start with nursing. But Father could not approve nursing as a profession, even when I told him that some of the nicest girls were going into it. "Well, they won't be nice long," he growled. Father's notions, however, were not going to divert me from my intention. No matter how peaceful the home atmosphere had become, still, I had to get out and try my wings.
No room, no room, no room, said the Mad Hatter. His brain had turned to batter from eating tuna fish or swordfish or some such matter. Something he ate, to be sure. Don't bring